Владимир Путин освободил Владислава Суркова.
О Суркове в ИЮ. Такое название указано.
Владислав Сурков отправлен в свободное плавание. Владимир
Путин подписал суверенную демократию.
Суркова по собственному желанию из правительства стал неожиданностью для всех.
Чем займется серый кардинал российской политики?
He was the gray cardinal of the Kremlin, the maestro of intrigue and the master of subterfuge. A puppet master of the make-believe who created fake political parties, imitation social movements, and who orchestrated stage-managed pseudo-pluralism. He devised a system he called sovereign democracy, which was anything but democratic, and for a decade or so it worked brilliantly. But the skills that made Vladislav Surkov such an effective ideologist and political manager for Vladimir Putin in the end also made him dangerous. Like few others in the Russian elite, Surkov understood Russian society and what made it tick. He knew which buttons to push to get the political reaction the Kremlin desired. And in the last few years, Surkov understood that the society he had so effectively manipulated was changing, and changing rapidly. An increasingly affluent middle class was rising. A post-Soviet generation was coming of age. Society was becoming more sophisticated and more complex. The old tricks wouldn't work much longer. The system needed to open up in order to survive. Surkov got this. Putin did not. This crucial disconnect cost Surkov his job. But what will it cost Putin? Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. On the Skype line from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And also joining us via the magic of Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies. Welcome, Sean.
Hello.
In the week or so since Surkov's resignation was announced, there is still very little consensus about the reasons behind it. The Kremlin says it's because the government has failed to implement President Vladimir Putin's decrees, something Surkov, as chief of staff, was chiefly responsible for. But few really buy this explanation. Media speculation has ranged from Surkov's conflict with the investigative committee over the criminal probe into the Skolkovo Scientific Center to his falling out with Putin after backing a second term for Dmitry Medvedev. Some, like Mikhail Rostovsky at Moskovsky Komsomolets, suggest Surkov resigned against Putin's wishes and is playing his own deeper game here, which would be quite fitting. Sean, what's your take? Did he jump? Was he pushed? What does this all mean?
You know, honestly, I'm not exactly sure. I mean, depending on which reason you take, you have a different perspective on what its meaning is. I tend to move more toward the conflict within the elite, just because it makes more sense. There was a campaign to discredit Surkov for a couple of months. Forbes.ru pointed this out in its attempt to figure out why Surkov was fired or resigned. And there seems to be a campaign to discredit Medvedev in general. So Surkov, as a Medvedev guy, seems to fall into this. But I think the most important thing is the meaning of it. Mm-hmm. And in this sense, Surkov left the building in late 2011. And since him leaving the head of the presidential administration, the tone of Putin's government has changed markedly. No longer is this attempt to have a managed pluralism. It's under Volodin. There's a much harder way of dealing with the opposition and dealing with society in general. So I think this is the real significance. Surkov left a long time ago, but his official leaving the government is kind of the last nail in an era.
Mm. Kirill, would you agree with that?
Partially, but we must remember the theoretical side of this problem. What was Surkov's mission? Surkov's mission as a political technologist or political expert or gray cardinal and so on was to provide Putin's regime with this pseudo-democratic institutions and, you know, all the image of the democratic country. That's why he tried desperately to invent a new language, first of all, a new political language, including all this, you know, terms like sovereign democracy and so on. So he tried somehow to explain a new regime to, firstly, to the population of the country, and secondly, to, you know, some countries or some forces outside the country, to the outer world. And he tried to do this, and here, in some sense, he succeeded to do this in the 2000s, or in 2000s. And the question is, if Putin's regime doesn't need this sort of politics, this sort of pseudo-ideology no more. And that is a theoretical question, because if we speak about authoritarian or semi-authoritarian regimes in Latin America, Africa, Middle East, and so on, they try, all of them try to keep maybe even the image, but the image of democratic institutions like parliament with, you know, several political parties with, you know, semi-free press and so on. Another example is China. China doesn't try to reach such goals as, you know, several parties democracy or, you know, general elections with the participation of several political forces and so on. They try to, and they succeeded, to keep all the communist, reformed, but old communist political structure and institutions.
With constant rotation, with rotation of leadership.
With rotation, it's very impossible. It's very impossible because Chinese officials, Chinese leaders, they understand that they cannot and they ought not to, you know, to close the social lifts, social elevators in mm-hmm. the country. They must rotate the political elite all the time mm-hmm. or this country will, you know, just will be destroyed. The political system will be destroyed. And that was the choice in the beginning of 2000s. If Russia goes, you know, this Latin American or third world way of imitating democratic institutions, or Russia will follow the example of China. Surkov tried to follow the first mm-hmm. way. And he, as we told, he succeeded in some sense in this. But now Russia is in a very Russia, not Russia, but Putin's regime or Vladimir Putin himself is in a very strange position. He's stopping to imitate democratic institutions and practices and so and measures and so on. And at the same time, he is not he doesn't stick to China. Chinese
he's not rotating. Example. He's not rotating
yes,
the elite.
Yes. Yes, it's a huge and a very, you know, uneasy situation. It's a gap, really, cul-de-sac. And that is the main political mistake made by Putin himself and his advisors, including Volodin. They even just don't know what to do next.
Yeah, this is my reaction when I read a lot of the commentaries in the press, particularly the editorial in Nezavisimaya Gazeta, which was saying that the era of the political technologists is over, that Surkovism is over, that you don't. But I don't know if a regime like this can survive without some make-believe. If the era of make-believe is over, then is this regime in deeper trouble than even we think it is in? Both of you can jump in on that. Sean,
I mean, I think certainly the Surkovian model of make believe is over, but we don't know if another model of make believe could generate itself, and perhaps this is the project of Volodin and the People's Front. Mm-hmm. Maybe the long term idea is to cobble together this wide coalition that's not really based in political parties, and that provide at some point an ideological cover. Or an ideological mechanism to justify the regime's existence. But I agree with Kirill. I mean, the main problem is elite rotation. And Russia, comparing to China is a little difficult because China's had 50, 60 years to figure this out. The new Russian system is fairly new, and the deal within the elite on rotation has yet to be made. I mean, this is one of my big observations about the Russian top elite, is its inability to come up with a game plan or an agreement amongst each other to rotate seats, but not pillage and cannibalize each other when somebody falls out of favor.
And this has never been the case, not even in the Soviet period. It's never been the only time it ever existed was with the Romanov dynasty, actually, when it was a hereditary monarchy. So I'm not sure I'm ready to say the Surkov era is over, quite frankly. The opinion I've come to on this, and I wrote about it in the blog this week, is I don't think Surkov, and I don't know, but judging from the tea leaf reading I've been doing all week on this, I'm kind of late to the party, but I tried to be one of the better dressed people at the party always, is that my reading on the tea leaf is that Surkov wasn't pushed, he jumped. And he jumped against Putin's wishes. Why do I think that? I think that because of all the confusion that we initially saw over this. I mean, really, what day did he resign? Was it May 7th or was it April 26th? And Medvedev was wonderfully wishy-washy on this. Well, he talked about it on both days. That's a minor point, right? But it's also very telling that Surkov's not even letting them control the narrative on this. He came out afterwards and said, I didn't resign on the 7th. I resigned much earlier. They just waited to announce it. Then all the confusion about who was going to be his replacement. I mean, it was almost comical. So they obviously weren't, or they appeared to not be ready for this. And I don't think Putin wanted Surkov to go. I think he wanted him to sit right where he was in the government and be part of his whipping boy. And as Rostovsky wrote in Moskovsky Komsomolets this week, and what I thought was one of the much better pieces I read on analyzing this, he wrote, now with Surkov out of the government looks pathetically weak. I mean, really, it looks real. Surkov gave that government at least some measure of, I'm loath to use the word gravitas with this government, but something that sort of almost resembled some gravitas. Without Surkov, this government looks really, really weak, and it's not going to be able to play that role Putin wanted for it. To kick it and for it to be the lightning rod for criticism when things inevitably go bad, when the economy turns down or when there's a crisis, and allow Putin to be the national leader above the fray. So I'm now, is this a signal that maybe he's ready to replace the whole government and go with a new model? I don't know. But I think my feeling on this, another thing that gave me a hint that that Surkov jumped and was not pushed was the coverage on Russian state television afterwards, which was very much flattering Surkov, was talking about how talented a manager and how talented a political technologist he was. That was pretty telling. That's not the treatment somebody who's out of favor usually gets. Yes, Sean, I agree with you. There's this fight in the – there certainly are people in the elite that wanted Surkov out. Ivanov and Sechin wanted him out for sure. But I'm not sure Putin did. And Putin's the one that counts here. So I'm not, but this is all pure speculation. Anything you guys want to throw into that? I mean, do you think it's outlandish to say he actually jumped against the president's wishes?
Oh, as for me, I am not sure that I can, speculate on about this, but there are two pragmatic, sides of the this whole situation. First of all, it's and you mentioned it already. It's a fate of Medvedev himself and the government. Of course, it's extremely weak. Moreover, its leader is no one. In the Russian politics, Medvedev now is no one. It's not just a laughing matter as it was several months ago. He is just no one, yes. And the government, which is led by no one, with a very weak ministers on some very important positions, with no support from the society. The president administration, even from Duma, just remember several scandals around several ministers, especially minister of education and so on, inside Duma. Yeah, and of course it's extremely extremely weak. But the question is, maybe Putin needs such very weak government to. To produce several steps, to make several steps in some very unpopular direction.
Does he need it to be this week, though? Does he need it to be this week? Because a government this week, could it take responsibility for anything? Sean, what do you think?
No, I think if it gets too weak, then it just becomes – and then people see right past it. But I actually want to go back to the issue, did he jump or was he fired? I don't know, of course. You know, I joined the bandwagon on the speculation train. But if he resigned unexpectedly and Putin didn't want it, and the sign for that is that they weren't ready to replace him, that suggests that these people have a plan. Mm-hmm. I think one thing that's been clear over the last year is that Putin's government doesn't really have a plan. It's an incredibly reactive government. Mm-hmm. It makes decisions based on certain events without really kind of putting them forward. And I can imagine, given the chain of events, particularly with the Markin article and Surikov saying what he said in England, and there's been some suggestion that somebody brought Putin the idea that Surikov signed off on $750,000 to Ponomarev, that the reaction was – and then on top of the meeting which he spoke out and challenged Putin on his claim that the government wasn't filling its directives, that the reaction was a kind of knee-jerk one.
Mm, that's certainly possible, yeah.
And it kind of falls in line with a kind of concretization of an us versus them scenario within the government, that if you're not with us, you're with them. Mm-hmm. Whether you are or not is not important. And there's been a lot of speculation in the weeks coming up to Surikov's firing resignation that Surikov was not one of them. He was of the other side.
Well, this goes to something I also raised on the blog this week, albeit briefly, but it's something I've spoken about a lot in the past, and that's what I call the manager's revolt. One of the ways that I prefer to look at this elite, I mean, is it Siloviki and technocrats? Is it what is? One of the ways that I think is really helpful is looking at this elite as shareholders and managers, right? Igor Sechin is a shareholder, right? He has a concrete, deep financial stake in the status quo and in this regime called, you know, Russia Incorporated, if you will. He's the CEO of Rosneft. And others like Timchenko would certainly fall into that category as well. Surikov is not. He's a manager. He's somebody that was hired to perform a specific task, just like Alexei Kudrin, whose resignation Putin neither expected nor wanted back when it happened in September of 2011. And you have to wonder now, the managers were the ones that were pushing for the system to open up, for the system to change, because they were skilled technocrats, and they, like Surikov and Kudrin, understood the society, understood the economy, understood that you could not continue partying like it was 2007 in 2012 and 2013. The shareholders, because they had a stake in the old system, were against change. The shareholders won that argument in the short term, and the managers appear to be defecting. I want to throw to both of you, does that argument hold water with you, and what are the implications if it does? Who wants to jump first? Sean, go ahead.
Yeah, I think, but the only problem with that is that Surikov was sidelined on that front well over a year ago.
He was sidelined, right? At the exact same time. It was really within a week of when Kudrin went out, if I'm not mistaken.
Exactly. And so it is clear that they decided to take a different – and another thing too that was been coming out in the last couple of weeks is the association of Surikov with his political technology is what created – the managed pluralism, what created the protests. Mm-hmm. The idea that the system was going to open up with Medvedev
– he created the expectations, actually, in a lot of ways.
And there seems to be at least from the press, some indication that at least, I don't know about Putin, but certainly the Siloviki or the shareholders, as you put them, saw him as to blame for what has happened over the last year.
Yeah, in December 2011, he was in a tough spot because the opposition blamed him for being the puppet master of this fake democracy. The Siloviki or the shareholders blamed him for creating this fake democracy that created the expectations that led to the protest. But I think everybody recognizes the man's talent and that he's useful. And for this reason, I don't think the man on the top really did want him to go, because I think he was going to fight. He wanted to keep him in reserve and probably find a use for him at some point. But what I can't get away from is it is people like Kudrin and like Surikov who are defecting. They have followers inside the elite to this day. Surikov's people are still in the Kremlin, and Volodin has been unable to get rid of them. And there are implications inside the elite for all of this, because you have the ostensible leaders of the whatever managerial class of the elite, political and economic in this case, still burrowed inside the elite. Remember, Medvedev brought in a lot of young people who sympathize more with the Kudrin slash Surikov approach right now than they do with the Siloviki and the shareholders. Kirill, I see you want to jump in here.
I think a key figure here in this discussion is Putin himself.
Of course.
because Putin inflicts at the same time adoration from one part of the Russian population and, you know, disgust and fear and whatever from other part of the Russian generation. And Surikov, and he is very witty and smart political technologist and so on the first stage of his official political career, tried to use this adoration in some sense in his own ends. Mm-hmm. And now he just understood that it's over. It's not over the adoration of this part of population. The latest, sociological research and polls show that everything is okay with, popular support of Vladimir Putin. It's a little bit less than it was, several months ago.
I would take issue
still
with that. I would say that level of support, it's in the 50s, is fine in a real democracy. But in an authoritarian system, you got to have more than that. You got to have more than that.
Yes, it's the first reason. But second one is that Surikov doesn't like this particular part of Russian population with its adoration to Putin. Surikov is on the side of the other part of Russian population, and he tried all his political career. He tried to, to be connected to this part, and
he comes from that part. Yeah.
Yes, and to feed. Just to feed this part with several, ideological conceptual ideas. He invented this language, as I told you, and so on. He tried to work with this. And now when regime is trying to change or to switch its electoral and political base from the wider part of population, including intelligentsia, middle class, and so on, to some Uralmashvagon, electoral base, Surikov definitely doesn't like this. Because, first of all, as a specialist, as a professional, and so on, he even doesn't know how to cope with them. He doesn't know even the words how to speak with all these people. And secondly, he understands me. I am not, exaggerating his ability of thinking about Russian future and his, generosity about, the all political climate in future Russia. But he, of course, he clearly understands that future Russian of the country and so on with this part of population, which now despised Putin and all this regime. And that's why if he wanted to jump out from this vessel, from this ship before the shipwreck, he did it.
Well, Kirill, what you're saying here, excuse me for interrupting, because it's hitting on something. It's something we've talked about a zillion times on the podcast. It's something I've written a zillion times on the blog. But this split in society is reflected in the elite, of course. This split between you call the Uralmash side of society and the creative class of the big cities is reflected in this split in the elite between the shareholders and the managers, the Siloviki and the technocrats, whatever, those that want the system to open up and change and those who don't. And this leads me to one of the big things I wanted to get into this discussion is this Cold War, as Sean, as you so aptly described it in your blog last week, is this Cold War about to go hot? And if it does, Well, both sides have allies on the street, so to speak, right? I mean, I've often wondered what's going to happen when what I used to call when Alexei meets Alexei, meaning when Alexei Kudrin meets Alexei Navalny, basically when the technocratic wing of the elite makes common cause with the moderate wing of the opposition. And Surkov leaving made me think it's getting closer to this, because I think there's a lot of truth to the fact that Surkov was playing footsie with the opposition. I don't think that was something they made up. I think it's well documented, and he when he was Kremlin ideologist, he used certain parts of the opposition for his own ends. So he had these contacts, and so I think and Kudrin's contacts with the opposition are not very well documented out in the open. So we're already beginning to see Alexei meeting Alexei, so to speak. And you got to wonder where this is going, because you see the elite in society divided along similar lines, and you begin to wonder if people like Kudrin and Surkov are going to have more in common with, you know, Navalny and Pomerov than they do with the others of their former colleagues in the halls of power. Sean, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, they certainly share the spirit of the opposition in this sense. Surkov said as much in London that the system needs to open up. And by this, I think Kirill is absolutely right, that he means to incorporate elements of the middle class and the urban centers. But it's clear that Putin's new coalition, and I think Surkov's departure is a good indication that cobbling out of a new coalition that includes the provinces, that includes conservative elements of Russian society, is the base of Putin's third term. The question then is, well, what does that mean for the shape of the system itself? But like I said, I think that people like Surkov and Kudrin share the spirit of the opposition, but do they actually see the opposition serious enough to be actual partners? That I think remains to be seen. So much so that some are predicting that after all of this settles down a bit, you might see a change where there's a sway towards at least some of the elite now going back to Putin. Will this Cold War get hot? Who knows? I think it's going to stay cold for a long time. I mean, there was an article, I think, on Sloan a few days ago that the era of protests is over. Now it's the era of court cases. And I think that this kind of slow simmering, taking people like Navalny to court might be the direction that Putin is taking, or Putin's government is taking, to deal with the opposition, rather than the kind of hard come down that we've seen over the last year.
Kirill, what do you think? Is the Cold War going hot? Is Alexei going to meet Alexei?
I think in some sense, yes. But I think the most important thing is that this part of the elite, which is now opposing these technocrats and so on, I'm returning to my initial idea of the lack of political language. If you're a real politician, you have to, invent or use already existing political language to explain yourself to the population, to the electorate, to people. And it's very important to people or politicians outside the country. Well, that is what, the politics means, the word, to explain somehow, not just to act somehow, but to explain somehow. And I'll finish my, explanation with some metaphor. There is a very important cultural, point in Moscow. It's an independent bookshop, a very small bookshop, Falanster. It's just in the very center of Moscow, on Gnezdnikovsky Periulok. It's near Tverskaya. And it's a very important place for all the people who is, reading the translated political, philosophical, sociological, historical literature, and so on. By the way, the owners of this independent bookshop, they are anarchists. They're former members of Limonov's party. But I'm speaking about other things. 5 years ago, of course, when I visit Moscow, I ever come to Falanster bookshop and met there with various people. I met there Gleb Pavlovsky, for instance. I met there several, you know, the radical anarchists and the feminist leaders, which, you know, participated in all these protests last year and so on. And I remember this famous photographs made by someone. I don't remember by whom, maybe, but by Rustam Agadamov or someone else, who made the pictures of the bookshelves in Surkov's cabinet. It's very interesting that, you know, roughly the half of the books were from Phalanstер Bookshop. I'm not, you know, exaggerating that that was, you know, some ideological or philosophical unity of former Limonov party members and anarchists and feminists and Gleb Pavlovsky and Surkov. But that was this, you know, the same base, or maybe same cultural foundation of all this activity. They could be enemies, but they were on the same ground.
They're now, on the same aesthetic ground, yeah.
Yes, and now this ground disappeared.
Well, Surkov has a poster, famously had a poster of Che Guevara in his office. In Kremlin. And started a place. Hold on, Sean wants to jump in here.
Yeah, I just want to make another comment about this, that in terms of the Cold War, and one of the things I tried to point out in blog post based on this Forbes article, is that the new political calculation of Putin's government requires enemies. And the problem with this is that enemies in a Cold War is fine because you can stabilize the situation. But it's a very dangerous game to play. If the Cold War goes hot, you lose control of how the configuration of enemies work. If things go hot in a situation where the technocratic wing of the elite is leaning more towards, say, the spirit of the street opposition, and they are of the, as Kirill points out, they are of the same type of people, then the enemy designation could burst out within the elite itself. And that is very, very dangerous. And then Putin will lose control of the elite as it tries to finger each other.
Yeah, and I personally think they are teetering on the edge of this and skating for their own good a little too close to this line. I mean, when did this Cold War start? I was reminded of it when I was reading up on this week. It goes back in the period, in the spring and summer of 2011, when all the speculation was as hot as can be about will Medvedev stay or will Putin come back. And Surkov and earlier Pavlovsky, who had already left, was pushed out earlier than Surkov, were arguing that the old Putin majority was dead. He's going to lose the middle class, and you have to create a new Putin-Medvedev majority that incorporates all this by opening the system up. These are all the things that Pavlovsky and Surkov were arguing for, this wider system of managed pluralism, more parties in the Duma, Medvedev stays for another term, rotation of the titular head of state. They were fine for the time being with leaving Putin de facto in charge of the whole show as the national leader a la Deng Xiaoping. But they thought that the system had to open up, and this was the beginning of the realization on the part of the other side of the elite that if they went this way, they could be in trouble in the long term. So that, I mean, I would trace this Cold War back to then, and it got progressively hot over time. Kirill, would you agree with that?
Yes, I agree, and I agree with the idea which was put by Sean, that the most important thing is the configuration of the enemies. You can play with the enemies if you are on the same, you know, cultural or social ground. If you have enemies which are, you know, just outside your world, you can kill them, or you just have nothing to do with them, and that's all. You can play only with those whom you understand and who understand you. Mm-hmm. And that is the rule. In the 2000s, Surkov tried to organize a sort of game with socially closed enemies mm-hmm. or opponents.
Yeah.
And that was rather interesting, rather disgusting, rather, you know, dull in some
But it gave us a lot to write and talk about.
Yes, yes. We had a lot of, we had a lot to talk about it and so on. And now this game is destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And Putin's regime is trying to play with some other forces. But first of all, regime doesn't understand these people. Mm-hmm. This, you know, Ural Wagon Marsh people and so on. That of course they don't understand them, and these people from Ural Wagon Marsh, they don't understand Putin regime.
Yeah.
First of all, secondly, he's trying to play with some other parts of the society, with the extra nationalists and so on. But they don't have even, you know, the same ground, because nationalist movements, especially radical nationalist movements, they're first of all anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
And the modern Putin's regime is not anti-Semitic at all, and couldn't be such.
Right.
And these people, they even just don't understand what they're doing with all these people and how they can use them. They try randomly, pragmatically from, you know, time to time, but that is very dangerous, because they don't understand the intentions of the other side of the game.
Mm.
And that's dangerous.
It is very dangerous. And guys, you have... Oh, Sean, you want to have one last word before...
Yeah, I just want to say one last thing on this in terms of the playing on the kind of cobbling together the conservative coalition with the provinces. The enemy's game and pitting the provinces versus the cities, or the working class versus the middle class, is really tapping into some very, very real grievances amongst people in the provinces.
They're playing with
that
fire.
Yeah, they're playing with fire, exactly. And this is far different than the early time when Surkov was constructing enemies of, you know, having Nashi go and harass various intellectuals in Moscow. I mean, this was, in retrospect, this is kind of child game enemies.
Yeah.
But tapping those deep-seated resentments in the countryside is playing with fire.
And it could spin out of control. And as long as we're talking about enemies, that's a opportunity for me to segue into the second half. In a few moments, we'll shift gears and look at the strange little spy scandal that engulfed Moscow this week. Who knew that American spies recruit collaborators while wearing wigs and carrying compasses, flashlights, and maps? I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. On the Skype line from London is co-host Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the excellent Sean's Russia blog. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Агент ЦРУ, работавший под прикрытием,
официально отреагировал на задержание в Москве американского шпиона,
который кадровый сотрудник ЦРУ, работающий
ночью органы контрразведки задержали американского шпиона. Он работает.
When Russian authorities announced they had detained a U.S. diplomat in Moscow on suspicion of spying last week, it raised eyebrows. Not because anybody was actually shocked by the practice, but because the circumstances were a bit strange. Ryan Christopher Fogel, a political officer at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, was allegedly detained while trying to meet a potential recruit. He was wearing a wig, carrying a compass, a map, a flashlight, a knife, large amounts of cash, and a letter spelling out the terms to his recruit. $100,000 for the first meeting and $1 million a year for cooperation thereafter. And the TV crews were on hand to broadcast the whole thing. Speaking to RFERL this week, one security expert described the whole thing as resembling, quote, a badly staged comedy from the 1970s, end quote. On top of it all, the detention was announced just as U.S. Ambassador Michael McFaul was about to start a live Twitter chat with the Russian people. Kirill, what exactly were the Russian authorities trying to accomplish here?
I think there are several, you know, aims of Russian authorities. First of all, maybe. No one can.
We don't know what. Yeah, yes, I mean, that's for Mark.
And
he's not here.
I can speculate about, you know, the espionage essence of the case. But we can speak about the public image and, you know, the language of
yeah,
the
I'm more interested in what they were trying to do here.
Pragmatically, first of all, I think they tried to make a blow to on American ambassador McFaul.
Yeah.
From the very beginning, initially, several you know parts of Russian political elite strongly against his appearance in Moscow. Mm-hmm. Yes, about his duty in Moscow, and I think that is one more blow to him. Secondly, they try to. Just returning to the same idea about the political language and so on, they're trying to reinvent somehow the archaic language of Cold War spy stories and propaganda, Soviet propaganda, because all this, you know, paraphernalia of this case, the compass, the cash and the instruction and so on, they're, of course, they're from a very bad Russian, not Russian, but Soviet propaganda movies about foreign spies inside, you know, healthy Soviet society and so on. So that is an attempt, and a very ridiculous, by the way, attempt to reinvent this Soviet language. Now, this language is not, you know, it couldn't be proved by the, you know, by pop culture, because if you try to invent some ideological language in which you want to use speaking with your own population, especially population, you must use the language of pop culture. Yes, because that is the only language you can use in the conversation with the society. Because if you use the language of pop culture in the situation or in the historical period after the power of Christian Church and so on, we live in secular society and so on, which language can you use? Not ideological, definitely, because there are no any ideology.
Okay,
now.
So they're using the language of pop culture, but I'm sorry. I mean, wigs and compasses. I mean, this is the 21st century. This is the age of the internet and smartphones. And I mean, come on. I mean, even your most ignorant segment of society is. I mean, does anybody buy this? I mean, really? I mean, the map of Moscow just got me. I mean, come on. This is the age of smartphones. Are you telling me the CIA can't afford an iPhone? Does anybody buy this?
Well, these are things. Speaking about the mistake, a serious mistake of Kremlin ideology.
Is the Kremlin that stupid? I can't think of a more polite word. I mean, come on. I don't think so.
Huh? The GPS is easily traceable, though.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this is the thing. I mean, if you use too fancy of technology, then you know nowadays you can trace really easy, and you can't trace a guy with this pocket atlas.
Apparently, you can. Yes, the FSB is so good.
Well, I guess so.
Sorry for interrupting you. In some sense, it's a paraphernalia of espionage, of organic, eco-friendly, and sustainable age.
And even in another age, I don't.
So on.
Even in another age, I don't think anybody's going to be carrying a letter while meeting their recruit and carrying cash. I mean, again, you could transfer money around the world via electronic transfer. Now, on the face of it, and I don't say this to say he wasn't a spy. I would not be shocked that the U.S. In fact, I'd be very disappointed if there weren't spies in the U.S. embassy in Moscow. But I mean, really, I mean, this. If they're trying to sell a bill of goods to their own population, this is absurd. This is positively beyond absurd. I mean, it's almost like it's postmodern to the nth degree. I mean, they're playing a joke on themselves and us, and everybody's laughing. I don't know. I mean, maybe they were trying to provide some comic relief for the Russian-American relationship. I don't get it. I wanted to go back to McFaul too, and one thing that supports your point that they were trying to embarrass Michael McFaul is when they announced this on TV. And I was watching this as we were getting the audio clips ready for this podcast. they were saying with these announcements that, an American spy was, they had a big picture of Michael McFaul's smiling face in front of an American flag behind the news presenter, and it said "Amerikanski spion," and they had the big thing. But whose head was there? It wasn't Fogel's head. It was Michael McFaul's head, just as he was starting his Twitter feed. So you're probably right on that they wanted to embarrass McFaul. Sean, you wrote what I thought was a very, very interesting and insightful blog post called The Cold Civil War that I referenced in the first part of the podcast on your blog this week, in which you described the nexus of internal external enemies, which is at the focal point of Putin's operating procedure right now. This seems to fit into this framework, no?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly that's the first thing when this broke in the news. The first thing I thought of is, okay, now they have the thing that Putin's been saying for a long time, that there are American spies in Russia recruiting oppositionists. And then it came out later that he was trying to recruit FSB. But at initially, this was my first thought, and I posed the question of, well, who's going to be the first oppositionist to be linked to Fogel. And it's interesting too. I mean, yeah, all of these, this spy case comes out with McFaul's, you know, Twitter conference and all of these things, but it also comes out with a new documentary about the That's May 6th right. That's right. Protests called Bolot. And the fact that they've been trying to, you know, link the Bolotnaya protests with foreign aid and foreign money, and I think ostensibly through via Georgia to America. So this does, in terms of the signal it sends, I mean, it's amazing. The drama of it is very contrived and over the top, and who knows, you know, if this guy was caught with all these things or they were planted on him as part of the show. But it's interesting that, you know, this coming on Russia Today.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is more for a foreign audience.
Right.
But it also goes in line with the general tactic that you have these kind of busts and searches on television.
Yeah.
Right. You have a reporter there with a camera.
Yep.
You're searching the opposition. They're there with a camera. You're busting a corrupt official. They're there with a camera. So it is playing on this kind of drama of various, you know, enemies that are inside and outside Russian society: the Americans, the corrupt, the opposition.
No, but I was going to say it's still. I just can't get past if you're going to do that, and I think you're right on the mark there. I think you're right on the mark, but why not create a drama that's a little bit more plausible?
I mean, and who knows? And a couple of things have come out. First off is that they threw out one of these guys, Fogel's predecessor,
yeah,
in January and didn't even mention it.
Right. Well, this kind of thing happens all the time. I mean,
right,
everybody knows that there is a CIA rep or more in every American embassy, and that there is a SVR rep in every or FSB rep in every Russian embassy as well. And we expel them, you know, periodically for whatever reasons, and it's always tit for tat, and the rules of the game. When you catch illegals like Chapman and her crew, that's a different game.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different game. But
this is also, I'm sorry, this is also, you know, the whole video of him being shamed.
Yeah.
I think this is the other thing. After the Boston bombings, and then to catch this guy, let's assume he's a spy, to catch him, and he's trying to recruit an FSB who happens to be connected to an expert in the Caucasus, to make a show of it after the Boston bombing. I mean, look at what they said.
Yeah.
We are cooperating with you now, and this is what you do. So I think this public shaming was really, really important on a kind of foreign relations front.
Mm, so maybe the wig and the compass were all part of the effort to make, look how stupid American spies are.
Exactly.
They still carry compasses and wigs in the era of smartphones, I guess. I thought what was interesting about that video was that the sound was off until they started talking about how could this happen as we're helping you with the Boston. Because
exactly.
I was watching that video, and I was like, where the hell's the sound? I want to hear what they're saying. And then suddenly it pops on, and you finally figured out that was intentional. They kept the sound off. I wonder what they were saying before that sound went on. You know, Kirill, any more thoughts on this?
That's my only idea, that they try with all this archaic details, with all this archaic language, cultural language, and so on. They're trying to gain both aims. First of all, I totally agree, it's a foreign aims, yes, to show America something. Yeah. And secondly, of course, they tried to connect themselves, the regime, the authorities tried to connect themselves to this new social base of their rule, of their power. And they tried to use the language they think these people use.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the result of the absence of Surkov.
Right.
Returning to the topic of our first part of the first part of our conversation.
Surkov would never have staged something this ridiculous.
Yes, of course, because Surkov can explain to Putin, not just to Putin, someone around Putin, that people in, say, you know, Kemerovo, they don't understand this language no more.
Right.
And that, you know, cash, knife and compass is something from the paraphernalia of, you know, detective stories of Soviet 1950s, which maybe Putin is fond from, you know, just now. Yes, maybe he's reading some spy stories of 1950s. There are a lot of them, or watching these movies in 1950s, Убийство на улице Данте, and so on. So may try now not just to follow his, you know, priorities, you know, cultural or aesthetic priorities just now. And they think that the words and the things which he likes now, which they're very common, you know, among the population outside Moscow, St. Petersburg, or, say, Yekaterinburg, and so on. So that is a pile of serious political, cultural, social, and aesthetic mistakes at the same time. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing I can say about this.
And not a peep out of Washington on this.
Well, they can't.
Yeah, it's standard practice, although days later, the U.S. national hockey team gave the Russian national hockey team an 8-3 thrashing in the quarterfinals of the World Hockey Championships in, I believe it was in Sweden. Go ahead.
One last thing, I guess, you know, we're making fun of the Russian side of all this, but, you know, we shouldn't also dismiss the fact that perhaps the CIA is this incompetent.
No. Wigs, compasses, maps, letters spelling out the terms of service while you're walking the streets of... Yeah, but I mean, really, this is true. We're talking about tradecraft here. And I'm sorry,
I'm not saying that the paraphernalia is of CIA origin, but certainly some of the elements in which this guy is trying to operate. I mean, they say now that he was under surveillance for 2 years, though I don't know what he had.
No,
when
look,
he came
I don't,
country.
I don't. I mean, I'm going to remain agnostic on whether he was a spy or not, because, everybody knows that espionage takes place out of embassies, and that everybody knows who everybody else's spies are, and we expel each other whenever it's politically convenient for either side. We tend not to try to, you know, humiliate the other side when this happens, unless there's a particular reason to.
Mm-hmm.
This went out of the bounds of all that part of the game. I mean, Russia was, and I know Putin was, really felt anger and humiliation over the whole Chapman affair. But I'm sorry, that was Knox. That was agents operating with non-official cover, illegals, as the Russians call them. That was a different kind of game. It's not assumed that we're both doing this to each other. And when you catch a ring like that, and in all fairness, I thought the U.S. handled that humiliated Russia to the least possible extent in that whole thing. I mean, it was kind of hard with the Anna Chapman, with all the everything that was associated with that, for it not to become a media sensation. But I think it was handled as well as it possibly could be handled, even though Obama was having a hamburger with Medvedev when the whole thing was about to go down. Any last words out of all you, before we wrap it up for this week?
I think the only, you know, outcome of the story is that John Le Carré must write a new novel with the title "A Spy Who Came with Compass."
Sean,
I have nothing else to add. It's just too weird.
that is a brilliant way to wrap up. That, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I would like to remind you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore. our author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. On the Skype line from London has been co-host Kirill Coburn of RFURL's Russian service and a contributor to the online magazine Politru. And also joining us via the magic of Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the excellent must-read Sean's Russia blog. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
I would also like to thank our brilliant and patient producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and certainly should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave with you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.